Our next speaker is Kelly Fraser, and she will talk about fostering collaborative research utilizing omic technology platforms to improve human health.
Thank you very much. So I'm Kelly Fraser, and I'm the director of the Institute for Genomic Medicine, which is in ORU in the UC San Diego Health Sciences. Okay, our mission is actually quite straightforward. Our goal is to foster and support collaborative cross-disciplinary research utilizing genome-scale experimental and computational methods to investigate disease aspects of biology and human disease, or diverse aspects of biology and human disease. And so I took it very seriously when I said people in the audience may not have a firm grasp on your concept, so start off and define what you mean. So what is genomics? And I think everybody knows what DNA is, right? And in the human, DNA is distributed on 22 autosomes, shown over there on the right panel, and two sex chromosomes. And this entire complement, so the entire DNA that is makes up the organism's component of inherited nucleic acids is known as the genome, all right? And genomics is the study of the genome. And so genomics includes sequencing, mapping, and analyzing DNA differences between individuals, which is shown over here on the panel to the right. Now, what is omics research? Okay, we just defined what genomics is, study of DNA, right? What used to be 10 years ago, traditional molecular biology disciplines of studying RNA has now become transcriptomics. You study the complete repertoire of the RNA in an organism. You're studying the transcriptomics. Similar for proteomics, when you're not studying a protein, but you're studying the complete repertoire of proteins of an individual or of an organism. And I think that it's really important to point out here that we're now at the cusp of where the future of biological sciences research is really going to be the integrative analysis across these different types of omic data. So the ability to understand how these data are generated, to be able to integrate analyses across them, this is where the next great insights are going to come from, both basic biology as well as use of healthcare. So why now in omics research is big data existing? And it really becomes from, and I'm speaking more from the nucleic acids now, genomics, transcriptomics, epigenomics, that round. It's really because in the last 5 years, actually starting about 7 years ago, there was huge technological breakthroughs in the ability to generate data. And these breakthroughs are continuing to come through. So there's massive amounts of data being generated. Right? And with that is the accompanying flow of many, many people that used to be in different fields, actually now coming into the biological sciences with their expertise to be able to analyze those data sets. And I think what's really kind of pulling this in many ways is the fact that many people see that these types of data sets, these types of analyses, are really what's going to be used to personalize healthcare in the not too distant future. So how has big data and omics research changed the playing field that we're all in? All right. It's really changed the training and educational needs of graduate students and postdoctoral fellows in the biological sciences. It's changed the types of research that is funded by the NIH, and it has changed the infrastructure required to generate and analyze these large biological data sets. So this is a graduate student, not that far along ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, before big data. A graduate student in the biological sciences would spend 5 years studying a very focused research question. a gene. You know, 15 years ago, you would study a gene. 10 years ago, you may have a dish, you may throw a drug on it. You may study before the drug, after the drug, look at transcriptomics, all right? Now, the graduate student has to learn how these data are generated, otherwise you do get poor data. If you're not training individuals, how errors creep into experimental data, what's a batch effect, how do you actually control when you set up the experiment so that you can actually analyze the data and get meaningful information? How do you have the computational skills, the ability to move big data around? How do you have the statistical methods to analyze those data? Graduate students, the next generation of scientists have skill sets that are now distributed in different types of fields. This is going to have to become a single field for the next set of experimentalists. So currently, the NIH funds big data research. We all know it's incredibly difficult to get an R01, all right? But last night, I did a very simple Google search. I typed in NIH RFA big data, all right? Tons of RFAs that the NIH has issued over the last These are all actually over the last 3 years, all right? I'm sure many of you know about the Centers of Excellence in Big Data Computing that was at the end of 2013. Genomic Centers for Infectious Disease. If you study infectious disease and you want to be at the forefront of your field, you need to hope that your institute is supplying the infrastructure that you need to pull in one of these centers, right? This is all commonly shared centers, all right? It's the same. If you study gene regulation, you're not going to be generating data for one of these big NIH-funded projects unless your university has the ability to generate that data. It's the same with cancer, the Genome Cancer Atlas, all right? So these are fundamental changes, shifts in how the NIH is funding research. So what is the infrastructure that's required? To generate the data, you need centralized, expensive laboratory equipment. And for these reasons, the bulk of those RFAs that have been released and funded have gone to very few institutes. They've gone to institutes that can generate data. And the people at those institutes are now, those institutes not only are attracting the people that can generate the data, but they're also really attracting the people that can analyze the data. Because it doesn't take too long to figure out that the places that are generating the data are the ones that are going to have first stabs at publishing on those data. And the people that have, want the people with the skills to analyze these data are really flocking to these sites. There's about 5 to 10 of them. I'm sure we all know which they are. So the Institute of Genomic Medicine is attempting to help UCSD with some of these issues as we transfer into this kind of new age. We really are involved in the education of the next generation of scientists. We have, seminar series. We have 33 faculty. We are trying to train the next generation on how to approach and practice integrative omics research. We have established and we're continuing to try to grow 2 central centers, one for the data generation, genomics data generation, and another for bioinformatics analysis. And the goal of these centers are to provide UCSD faculty the ability to use these centers to secure large NIH grants, as well as the access to expertise on how genomics data should be generated, processed, and analyzed. And finally, we are looking forward to participating in the recruitment as well as retaining faculty
that have these expertise here at UCSD. Thank you.
Sorry, it's me again. One of the things is that one single person can no longer handle this data. Even if you have somebody trained to analyze it, there's going to be so many answers that are given. Is there any thought of moving this into the realm where you can have community analysis of the data? Because that's when it becomes useful.
Yes, and that is exactly where the NIH is headed with their funding strategy, as I'm sure you're aware of, these centers, right? Centers generate the data, they post them to public data sites where a lot of people go to download the data to analyze it. So there is the secondary post-analyses. But really, there are many components that are needed in order to generate and analyze data that is actually going to be meaningful in the biomedical sciences, right? Right now, the ability to do these things are distributed amongst multiple people. You need people who actually understand what the biomedical question is. I mean, that seems obvious, right? But it's true. And so if you need somebody who actually understands, you know, Crohn's disease, and you need access to patient populations. That's actually not something that I found at UCSD is particularly strong at. So we need to figure out how to get better patient populations collected. All right. And then you need people who actually understand the machines, the equipment, what type of artifacts they generate. How do you design the experiment to try to overcome those artifacts? All right. And then you need people with the computational ability. So it's already interdisciplinary in that way. And if you design an experiment correctly, which you obviously should spend a long time designing experiments. I mean, the problem is that people in the biomedical sciences are not used to designing experiments in this way. They're used to going into the lab, doing a quick look-see, which costs $200, then figuring out what controls to put in, okay? These are experiments which actually you have to think long and hard about because they cost a lot of money and they take a long time to do. And you don't want to spend $1 million and realize you forgot the controls you needed for the experiment. So it's a fundamentally different way of thinking about how to do biomedical research.
I speak as an old man and as an adjunct faculty, so I'm very poorly equipped to see the future. However, I am a little bit concerned that you reduce everything to omics, or you seem to. Maybe it's not the intention, but that's what it sounded like. Biology is more than omics. There are phenomena which need to be discovered. The discovery of phenomena does not necessarily depend on omics. It depends on an insight, a special view of things. An example is what Peter's doing. He's not doing it. He didn't start out by doing omics. It leads him to omics. Omics is what comes next. But the discovery often is not just based on omics.
I agree with you, and you're probably better positioned to see the future because you've seen more of the past, okay? So I agree with you in that sense, and I think that some of this, much of what has been done in the omics realm is actually taking what has already been discovered by an individual scientist, right, and scaling it. I don't want to suggest that the individual scientist thinking about how something works and testing it out on a small scale is something we want to eliminate. I think we want to foster that. I think we want to foster that more than it is, right? But we also want to give that person that is doing that the ability to throw it on a sequencer real fast and get the answer back, right? We don't want the individual scientist to be impeded by not having access to technology.
Well, I'd just like to echo what Kelly has eloquently said about the fundamental importance of experimental design. And that's something that cuts across many, many, many areas that we've been talking about. It was part of the Nature Medicine editorial. And a second point is, like experimental design, there are many commonalities to these big data problems. And big data, it's often not just the scale of the data, it's the complexity of the data. We all appreciate that. And the devil's in the details, again, as Kelly alluded. So it takes people with expertise in these basic data science areas. And of course, my perspective is statistical, but there's data science expertise distributed around this world, or around this room. So it takes people with that kind of expertise who are embedded in the subject areas. And I think that really speaks to these joint recruitments that have to happen. So that you've got somebody who lives in both worlds, in the data science world with a foot in the domain of interest.
Yeah, thank you. Andrea LaCroix from Family and Preventive Medicine. Nice to meet you, Kelly. A couple of points. You say the importance of educating postdocs and graduate students, but I'd like to impress on you how much faculty need training in these areas. If we're going to partner with you as these new technologies emerge, we've got to know what it is that's going on with them. Second, I think we need to close the gap between the data that's available that the taxpayers have already invested in that is becoming increasingly rich with opportunity and making the connections with all these technologies that could make use of those data. So we've got a ton of really excellent data, stored RNA using the latest methods and so forth that nobody knows about. And we should be getting some match.com going on with the data and the questions that we can answer. And the third point I just want to make is we need some small successes marrying these things so that when we write our grants, we can say something materially persuasive. And so we did partner last year to respond to provocative questions for NCI with biomedical engineering and tried a sort of expansive omics approach. And actually, I think one of the big problems is the study section doesn't even know what we're talking about. So there's a lot of gaps to close here, but if we could bring some projects to fruition and explain them using these translational omics technologies with human population data, I think it would be terrific.
I agree.
Kelly, can I point you back on something with Samit? I think we're all talking about different omic technologies, and I don't think we're necessarily saying that every omic technology should be applied to everything and get data from everything and then plug it out. I mean, clearly, there are a lot of great examples of genomics having huge insights in cancer and other areas, and not so much great efforts in say, diabetes or other kinds of complications. So,
I mean,
you know, a lot of...
Oh, see, I
there's certainly examples in both areas, but there clearly are a way to decide where should we put our energy and which should be taken.
There are limited resources, and whenever there's limited resources, there has to be a dialogue on how to spend them. But here, right, the central platforms that are being put in for maybe, you know, mass spec for proteomics or metabolomics, right? But the different omics, by and large, use the same instrumentation. Right? It doesn't matter if I'm sequencing the metagenome for an IVD analysis or looking at an individual's genome to try to figure out why they have a particular undiagnosed disease. I'm using the same equipment. So I think that UCSD needs to seriously think about how to put this equipment in. And I realize that the knee-jerk reaction is that it's expensive, it becomes outdated quickly. But on the other hand, I think that to be a continued for UCSD to continue in at the forefront of NIH funding, at the forefront of discoveries. It's important for us to figure out how to put in what we need to put in, and it's going to change, but we got to be flexible, and we got to be able to change as you know, technologies move on.
Okay, one more short question.
I guess we've kind of segued into the discussion already, but thinking about some of the themes of this panel, I think like when it comes to big science, new models for looking at data, I think that implementation science is another thing that we've got to be thinking about. Because you know, if we're thinking about a new technology, yesterday's technology is today's everyday technology. So in our lifetime, laptop computers and cell phones have become just commonplace. But at a global level, we need to understand why some new interventions or technologies get adopted and others don't. What are some of the factors at the city level or organizational level that are either going to promote or impede the scaling up of a successful technology or an intervention? And that's where implementation science comes in. I think getting back to what UC Brenner was saying earlier, that the humanities can really offer a lot in this respect as well. Because, you know, in India, I've been to the state of Orissa where toilets were not anywhere to be seen, but you could get Wi-Fi anywhere. And so why are not people using the toilets that are sitting there? Well, I mean, there's cultural reasons for this that the anthropologists can help us understand. So I think with these kinds of issues really do bring together a lot of different disciplines to answer the same kind of questions from a different lens.
Well, I want to thank all four speakers for their wonderful presentations, and also the audience for the active participation. This session is now closed.